Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
My first guest has been on public radio long enough to have had a piece introduced by NPR host Susan Stamberg. Richard Parker did commentary for KCHO for 10 years, the last three for CalNet, which included about 20 public radio stations all over California. He also wrote a column, Parker at Large, for the Chico News and Review. Retired Chico State philosophy professor Richard Parker is co-author, along with his colleague Brooke Moore, of a textbook on critical thinking. It seems more than ever we can all benefit from tips on critical thinking. Richard Parker, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
Now, if you teach critical thinking, what do you think is important for us to know as far as what pitfalls we might get into?
Taught, not teach.
Oh, yes.
Remember that part about being retired?
Yes. You taught critical thinking.
Yes.
But you still have a hand in a textbook on critical thinking.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I still make my little adjustments, although my partner Moore has taken over the bulk of the work here because this is the last version of the text, which would be the 14th edition, but they call it the 2024 release because from now on it's not going to be printed in paper or very little. It's going to be mainly online or almost exclusively online. Students and faculty can print out copies from their online version. And I don't know how it's going to work. But I'm sort of backing out of it after 38 years.
This book has been available for 38 years, and I think the reason that people like it so much because it's a bestseller is because of the humor that you two bring to your book.
Well, we try to. I thought this photograph of Taylor Swift in here was going to have a caption that said. There is a version someplace about this. The Taylor Swift doesn't care for our book. and, of course, the reason is she's never heard of it.
So you won't hear Taylor Swift talking about your book on critical thinking.
Probably not. Not unless some – no, never. Anyhow. Yeah, critical thinking is fighting a losing battle. These days, at least when you look at the world or our country at large, anyhow, in politics, I haven't heard a decent argument for I don't know, maybe 1960.
Well, it seems like for a debate that critical thinking would be essential
for
a debate.
It's what debate is all about. I mean, debate is about producing rational arguments in favor of a position or against a position, and that is what critical thinking is devoted to accomplishing. Now, what we say in the book about critical thinking is that it's a matter of evaluating something or other with respect to some criteria. And that's the critical part. It's a matter of critique. You're critiquing something. That doesn't mean you're criticizing it. You can be saying good things about it, and it's just part of your critique. But that's what it amounts to: evaluating something, a position, a claim, a statement, according to whatever relevant criteria you have.
My guest is Richard Parker, and he's a retired philosophy professor who has had a best-selling book on critical thinking. And so I've asked him here to give us some tips on critical thinking. So what else is it good for us to know about critical thinking?
Well, it's maybe the most important thing to know is what gets in the way of critical thinking. And Daniel Kahneman and his associate, whose name is Amos something or other, I've forgotten what, back in the 1970s, introduced the term cognitive bias. And cognitive bias gets in the way of any kind of rational thought. It's broken down into several different you can break it down into several different forms. Probably confirmation bias is the best known and probably the most prevalent. And that's simply a case where you more readily accept information that you already believe, or that you're already familiar with, or that you approve of.
So if I read a study that says coffee is good for you, and there's another study that says coffee is not good for you, I like coffee, so I'm going to go with the study that supports what I already believe.
You are much more likely to agree with the conclusions of that first one, yes. Other versions of that are what we call in-group bias. And that's simply a matter of I believe this because the people I hang with, my group, they all believe it, and we believe it together, as it were. And now you find a lot of that in politics. I mean,
I think high school students. Yeah. I think there's an in crowd.
Oh yes.
And so in the high school students would be much more likely to say, "Oh well, these people in the in crowd believe this, so I'll go along with them."
Yep, exactly. A standard fallacy in every critical thinking or logic book is something called the bandwagon fallacy. And you simply adopt a position because it's the popular position, and everybody seems to be believing it, and so you jump in there and believe it yourself. And the last one I would mention almost off the top of my head would be repetition. Goebbels, who was the minister of propaganda during the Nazi regime, he once said that if you get somebody to hear something, or if you repeat it to them enough times, you can convince them that a square is a circle. actually, I think he also said you could convince them of anything.
Well, when I used to do musicals, the choreographer would sometimes have us repeat a step. And he said, if you repeat the step often enough, the audience will applaud, even though it's not a difficult step. But if you repeat it often enough, people will think, oh, that's good.
Well, that's a different one, a different take on the matter. I hadn't heard that. I know another thing. You know, there's a lot of talk about crime lately. And according to several surveys, polls, crime is an important issue for an awful lot of Americans these days, despite the fact that crime is, in fact, diminishing, especially violent crime. The homicide rate in almost every large American city is down. But why is it then that people think that crime is growing? And the reason is simply they hear about it all the time.
If it bleeds, it leads, I've heard.
Yeah, right. The more frequently you hear about something that it's in your mind, that's not the same as it being frequently happening in fact. And there can be all kinds of diminishments in all kinds of crime. But if every crime is reported and blared all over the place on the television and the radio and in the newspapers, people are going to think there's more crime because they just hear about it more.
And, you know, you just said the word they hear about it more, because I'm thinking we used to get the newspapers were our source of information.
I've forgotten what they look like. Made out of paper? Or, you know.
But I think if people were to read things, they would be more likely to pause and think about it critically than if they see video on TV, say, or on their phones.
Oh, I agree entirely. I think reading is where, I don't know, maybe it's the fact that I was forced to read so much as a graduate student, but reading is a way of getting something into your head. It's much more efficient than just hearing about it or seeing it on television, because what's shown on television while they're reporting on whatever the subject is usually a talking head, and so there's nothing much. If they were doing circles and diagrams and that sort of thing, then that might be helpful. But that's not what you usually see.
This is true. So you've been telling us about some of the pitfalls that keep us from thinking critically. Anything else that we should be wary of?
Well, there's a new development called whataboutism. Have you heard that for,
no.
that word? Well, here's an example. Right now, today, as a matter of fact, and yesterday, there have been charges in committee about President Biden's handling of classified material, and that keeps being brought up every time somebody mentions what former President Trump has done. But when people mention his crimes, but the immediate response is, what about Mr. Biden?
To deflect the criticism.
It's a subclass of what has always been known as a red herring. The phrase red herring got adopted because a herring is a very strong-smelling fish, and if you drag it across a dog's path who's following a scent, he'll get distracted and follow the herring. And for that reason, it's called red herrings because it's simply a distraction. It gets you off the point, or it gets you can get you to change your mind. But
so, if you're listening to a report like this, thanks to you, Professor, we will think twice about, this is an example of whataboutism. So yeah. I'm not going to fall for it.
Right.
I'm going to think critically.
Right. Incidentally, we don't mention whataboutism in the book here, but we do talk about red herrings, and it's just a version of that.
Would you also, you kind of caution us about taking somebody else's word that isn't worth taking?
Oh, yeah. It's a matter of credibility of a source. I use the phrase in the textbook, the phrase interested party. And what you really want to hear from are disinterested parties. I mean, if you're considering the features of an automobile that you're thinking about buying, the last person you ought to pay attention to is the salesman. I know for a fact that I was trying to buy for a former wife of mine. We wanted to get her a certain model, a coupe, and they had one on the lot. I won't mention which lot, but they had one on the lot, and the salesman said, why don't you try this one? And I looked inside, and I said, does this have GPS? And he said, no. And I said, we want one with GPS. And he said, a complete lie, they don't put GPS in the coupes, only in the sedans. Well, I went to another place and ordered a coupe with GPS and got it within a week.
My guest is retired professor of philosophy, Richard Parker, who is co-author of a book on critical thinking. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, philosopher Richard Parker, who's giving us tips on critical thinking. And it seems to me we could all benefit from critical thinking these days.
We could, as a matter of fact, but we probably won't. And one reason is that, to contrast with logical reasoning, we could put persuasive rhetoric or rhetorical devices that are just pure persuasion. And I think Moore first made this point.
Your co-author.
I didn't want to believe it, but he convinced me that rhetoric actually is usually more persuasive. It's more effective in getting results than logical argument.
That's a subject that used to be taught in schools many years ago.
Yeah, well, there's rhetoric, and then there's there's rhetoric. This is pure persuasion, and it usually involves an appeal to emotion of one sort or another, or an appeal to something that somebody already has a powerful belief in.
You know, speaking of what we used to teach in the past, in my high school, there was a debate team, but they were really outstanding debaters. They were championship debaters. And so I didn't think I was worthy. I wish now I had learned something about debate. And I'm thinking, okay, if we offer debate just for a certain level of students in our high schools now, why couldn't we work in critical thinking and teach high school students or earlier critical thinking?
Well, there's no reason not to. As a matter of fact, there's every reason to do it. And the earlier we started, the better. There's no reason at all that critical thinking can't begin in elementary school. And I don't know, I'm not an expert on that, but maybe kindergarten or first grade even.
Well, and I was thinking, okay, if we teach high school students critical thinking, probably we couldn't get it as a separate course. But it seems like critical thinking could be a part of any subject in high school.
It is a part of every subject. It just doesn't get treated that way, at least not very often.
I mean, if you're writing an essay for your English class, it seems like that would be really handy to be able to present your point of view in a cogent manner.
Yeah. I was looking through here, looking through the book earlier this morning, we deal with a section on definition. Now, you might not think that's such a, does that sound like critical thinking?
Definition? It's black and white, definition of something.
I just look something up in the Merriam-Webster,
Yeah.
But, stop and think then about the phrase personhood. There was a lot of talk for a long time on reproductive health for women about when human life begins, and you don't hear much of that anymore, thank heavens. But the phrase has turned to personhood, which makes a whole lot more sense. When do you call this object a person? My take on this is that this is not something you discover. This is something you decide, that there's not some clear moment in which it's obvious that this organism becomes a person. And unless you have some sort of strange metaphysical thing like when it's imbued with a soul and something like that, but then try to figure when that happens. You know, they used to weigh people right before they died and again right after they died, trying to figure out how much the soul weighed.
I've heard of that.
Really, truly, my word. But just getting your terms straight sometimes solves a problem. But if you disagree about a term, you're never going to get together on a conclusion. Anyway, if I had to recommend one tool, it would come from the 14th century. Yes, William of Ockham. You've heard, I'll bet, of Ockham's razor.
Yeah.
Which I think the original Latin would translate as "don't multiply entities beyond necessity." And in other words, the modern common sense way of putting it is that if you have two competing explanations for an event, pick the simpler one. Choose the one that requires you to commit to the fewest extra entities or objects or forces or whatever.
So if we want to explain how our days work, we say, okay, the Earth rotates around the sun. That wasn't always what the common belief was.
No, that's true. But what we have to go here is the evidence, and we didn't have much evidence, many, many years ago. But my version of this that I like best, I heard that it was used in medical school, but It's simply that when you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, not zebras.
I have heard that, yes. Yes. My guest is retired professor of philosophy, Richard Parker, and his book that he co-authored is Critical Thinking, and it's been through many editions. It's a very popular seller. People like it because he and his co-author, Brooke Moore, present it with humor. And in the latest update, you're saying that you're going so modern that the next version is going to be all online.
Yeah, this version is mainly online also.
The newest one, yeah.
The newest
2024 one. Edition. Yeah. You tell us, I mean, it seems to be logical, not to believe everything we hear.
No, don't believe. Matter of fact, my mother used to say, believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. And she wasn't entirely wrong about that. But because a lot of people, when they speak to us, either directly or by the radio or on the television or whatever, they are likely to have a reason for wanting us to believe what they're saying. And their reason may have nothing to do with the reasons for the thing being true, for the claim being true.
Well, I was younger. I used to believe I'm putting this in quotes, experts, because I figured, oh, well, they know. And then I learned, no, the experts aren't always right based on my own experience. So now I try to see, okay, what, just like you were saying, what is their motivation? Do they represent a company that sells a particular product and therefore they want me to believe a certain way? I'm much more skeptical now than when I was younger.
Well, that's, I approve of that on your part. However, there's an anti-expertise momentum in the country these days. Well, I mean, look at Anthony Fauci. He was an absolutely perfectly fine scientist, and he's been for 30 years trying to promote Americans' health, and yet he became a demon. I don't know how many cars and trucks, mainly trucks, I guess, I saw in Chico that had a picture of Fauci behind bars on the back window.
But he wasn't trying to get me to buy something that he would benefit from.
No, he wasn't. But he was an expert, and expertise has been, looked down on. There's an anti-science momentum in the country.
Yeah. Oh, there's no such thing as climate change, Richard.
I know. Yeah. It was cool this morning. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
So I've heard of arguments that are either deductive or inductive. And I think maybe people have heard more of deductive reasoning than inductive. So why do we put these labels on arguments?
Well, there are two radically different kinds of reasoning. A deductive argument is designed to prove its conclusion given the truth of the premises. An inductive argument makes this conclusion more likely. Well, put it this way. If we have a bowl of marbles here or a can of marbles that you couldn't see in and you knew it had 10 white marbles and one black marble, we can calculate in this case exactly what the probabilities are of your picking that black marble out the first time. And if once that marble is first drawn, of course, if you get a white one, then the odds change. But the thing is, if there's only one marble in there and it's black, then you pick one out, then you can deduce, for sure. And it makes for a deductive argument. I always mention on this subject that it's the only thing Sherlock Holmes ever got wrong, that he talks about the science of deduction in his very first story, and I think it's in A Study in Scarlet. But it was actually induction. Almost every argument he comes up with is an example of an inductive argument.
Well, you know what? You inspired me to take a volume of Sherlock Holmes off my shelf, my bookshelf at home. So I'm thinking that maybe your information will be the spark that will ignite an interest in critical thinking in the listeners. And I want to thank you for your presentation.
You're very welcome. And I would like to think that was true. But I'd like to think a lot of things that aren't.
My guest has been retired professor of philosophy Richard Parker. He is co-author with his colleague Brooke Moore of Critical Thinking. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
After a break, I'll be talking to author Reuven Fenton, who is a journalist and has written his first novel, Goyhood. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest has been covering breaking news for the New York Post since 2007 and has earned national recognition for his exclusive reporting on national stories. Journalist Reuven Fenton is a graduate of Yeshiva University and Columbia School of Journalism. He is author of a nonfiction book, Stolen Years, Stories of the Wrongfully Imprisoned. He has now written a novel, Goyhood, described as funny and compassionate about goys, Jews, and that crisis-prone identity, the male at middle age. Reuven Fenton, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, the listener might say, did she say boyhood? No, I said goyhood. So maybe they might like you to explain that title, Reuven.
You know, it's funny because when you Google goyhood, it hasn't gotten out there enough yet that automatically the Google results are going to come back as boyhood, which is most commonly seen as a movie that came out some years ago
by
Richard Linklater.
Yeah, we have to
override
autocorrect. But
hopefully soon it'll be recognizable enough that won't keep happening. No, but the name, I struggled with coming up with a title for this book. I came up with a dozen different possibilities. And then eventually, as I was writing on, I came to a scene where the protagonist himself reflects on a situation he's in, and he calls it goyhood. It's like this is the situation I'm in, because the story is about a guy, an Orthodox Jew, who discovers in middle age that he's not, in fact, a Jew. And, you know, havoc ensues, basically, in his life. He goes on a wild road trip with his estranged twin brother. Anyway, over a series of misadventures, at one point, he's just in this particularly awkward bind. And he thinks to himself, goyhood. This is goyhood. And that's when the title came to me, because essentially it's the position of being in a situation in which you thought you were a Jew, but you're actually not a Jew.
Well,
that is the definition I'm given.
Even the illustration, the words, the word goyhood, the capital letter G has a little bit of humor in it, I think. Tell listeners what's on that G.
Isn't that cute? Isn't that cute?
It is cute.
The artist very cleverly put a black yarmulke on top of the letter G, which was perfect, because G actually is the key letter in the word goyhood. That's what's different. It's what differentiates it from boyhood and what gives it its kick. So I thought it was a very clever decision. Actually, not one that I had thought of myself. This was the artist.
I thought it was clever too. I enjoyed
it. I thought it was great. Yes, thank you.
Now, I was interested in your dedication, because you dedicate it to a couple of doctors, but you don't tell us who they are.
This is what happens when you you're not sure you know whether you got a second novel. You hope you do, but in the meantime, if this is my only novel, I'm torn between dedicating it to my mother and to my wife. And so I said, which one? You know, who's going to you know, it's got to go to one of them. You know, I don't want to offend the other one. And all of a sudden it occurred to me, I said, hey, I'll dedicate it to both. Now, is that a cop-out? Maybe. But,
are they both?
You know, I thought I'd play it safe.
Yeah, you they're say both, two they're doctors. Both,
yes, my one's a psychologist. That's my wife. And the other one is a psychiatrist. That's my mother. So.
Well, then I wondered, well, when you were writing this book, who did you imagine your readers would be?
You know, it's a good question. You know, people always advise writers, you know, write the novel that you want to read. Okay, so what if the novel you want to read actually pertains to something that is really kind of unique and you know, definitely interesting to you, but will be interesting to the public at large. So I wanted to do a novel that a mass audience, a Jewish audience for sure, and just as equally a secular or you know, non-Jewish audience would altogether would enjoy. This was a story I wanted to tell very badly. This concept, this what if, like what if this happened to somebody, you know? But how am I going to make this a story that, you know, everyone can appreciate? And so that was the challenge, was writing a story that is a secular novel. This is not a Jewish, it's a Jewish novel, but it's not a religious novel.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's
oh,
my publisher is not Jewish. My editor is not Jewish. You know, and so the challenge was actually writing a novel that, as I say, was Jewish but not religious. And I think I pulled it off. You know, I dare not compare myself to the great Chaim Potok, who wrote the classic book The Chosen. But I think it is comparable to that in the sense that The Chosen is a novel that was written for a secular audience, but is a deeply Jewish novel.
My guest is journalist Reuven Fenton. And the title of his novel is Goyhood. Now, I would like you to introduce us to the characters, starting your prologue. And I was interested in this, too, because I happen to know a couple of brothers. One went to university on a football scholarship. He was built like a football mm-hmm. player. And his brother was a slender, wore thick glasses, and played piano and went to Brown and studied classics. So mm-hmm. when I was reading this, I thought, well, yeah, people might say, how can these two characters be brothers? But I know they can be. So would you read us the first page of your prologue?
Oh, certainly. It was a heat wave, the likes of which New Moab hadn't seen since 1938, when 33 residents died and scores more were hospitalized with sunstroke. Modern cooling staved off a second onslaught, but outside, flowers wilted, lawns yellowed, and garden rodents burrowed deep underground to sleep it off. On his third straight day indoors, 12-year-old David Belkin got up at noon. He found a party bag size of Doritos and turned down the bold and the beautiful. He stayed on through The Young and the Restless, and As the World Turns. 14 minutes into Guiding Light, he had an epiphany. If he was going to fry his brain anyway, he might as well do it as God intended. He stripped down to his shorts, took a tablespoon from the kitchen, and went out the back door. The air was like vaporized cooking oil, coating his throat and nasal passages. Undeterred, he sat cross-legged in the shade of a pecan tree and set about prying at the cracked clay with a spoon. It was a labor, and pretty soon sweat beads clung to the brown fuzz on his chest and lower back. The spoon got slippery, so he took it by the head and chipped away with a handle. The screen door clattered, and he looked up at his brother, Marty, younger by 43 seconds, came down the porch steps. The twins had the same high foreheads, Roman noses, and light chestnut hair, but David was built like a linebacker with a brick red skin tone. Marty was slight and fair, with prominent blue veins on his temples. His normally keen eyes had a strange, vacant look, and he was walking like someone with rheumatoid arthritis.
This is journalist Reuven Fenton, and he is reading the prologue of his novel, Goyhood. Now, you want to kind of fill us in then? Because I'm going to ask you to read a little bit more, a few pages further into your novel, where they're leaving their bikes on the curb.
Well, I mean, what's going on here is it's the 1990s, where we're being introduced to these twins who we quickly understand live in a rural, rundown neighborhood. They're bored. They have no money, and it's kind of obvious that things aren't going so well for them in their lives. It's alluded to the fact, you know, their mother, there's some allusions made right away that their mother's sort of doing her own thing, you know, kind of promiscuous and not maybe not the best mother. And, you know, these two boys are left to their own devices. So they, you know, decide to go, you know, break the tedium and go take a bike ride and get some ice cream and, you know, to go and, you know, enjoy themselves a little bit to break the tedium of this heat wave and this general summertime boredom.
So they left their bikes on the curb.
The twins left their bikes on the curb and crossed the yard to meet the stranger. "Boys," Adamai said, "I'd like you to meet the new rabbi of Moab. He's just arrived 2 days ago from New York with his wife and baby boy." "Girl," said the man. David gawked at the beard with his mouth slightly ajar. "Quit staring and introduce yourself," Adamai said. "David, quit staring and introduce yourself," Adamai said. "I'm Dave." The rabbi shook his hand. "My name is Yossi Kogel. It's a pleasure to meet you, David." "David, did you know that your namesake is the greatest king who ever lived?" "My what?" "David Amelech, King David. He lived about 3,000 years ago." The boy swatted a mosquito on his back. "Why was he the greatest?" "Well, when he was just a shepherd boy, he defeated a very bad giant with a single rock. Later, when he became king of Israel, he made Jerusalem the capital and brought together all the tribes of Jacob. He also wrote the Book of Tehillim, or Psalms."
You just mentioned Psalms, and I was impressed that you apparently translated the Bible verses in your book yourself.
Well, I've got a bit of a Jewish education behind me. Yes, I did. You know, a lot of that actually had to do my publisher. We were undecided about whether or not we wanted to use an old translation that was not that was past the copyright date. But it struck me as too old sounding, or that the style was off for a contemporary audience. So I actually went through each verse and I did my own translation.
Well, now when I'm reading your book, so much of it is unfamiliar to this whole culture, and mm-hmm. I've lived in several foreign countries, but I knew it was foreign culture, and it almost didn't seem as foreign as when I'm reading your book, because it's a lot of the vocabulary is new to me. But there is an overlap in your what you describe in your book and my experience, because back many years ago, my husband and I decided, okay, we're going to leave the city, we're going to move, and we're going to have a back to the earth. So we moved to the Appalachian Mountains. And not very far from where we lived was a scene that you, well, that has a role in your book, and that's the Appalachian Trail. And so I would like to skip to that part in your story where this woman they meet is going to Springer Mountain. So this is on, this starts on page 122, Reuben.
Okay.
Where Mayer took his first sip of coffee.
It was cold. Beyond the enclosure, he saw four birds with orange and black plumage take flight from a banana plant. Icterus belbele, Baltimore Orioles, males. "How about you let us take you to the airport?" David said.
And she says, "Oh, I'm not flying."
"Then let us take you to whatever transportation hub you're leaving from. Where are you headed, by the way?"
"Georgia."
"Oh, yeah? Whereabouts?"
"It's called Springer Mountain."
Mayer looked at Charlene square in the face for the first time. "You're hiking the Appalachian Trail?" She nodded. He couldn't help staring. As a kid, he dreamed of hiking the epic mountain trail from Georgia to Maine, keeping a log of the birds he saw along the way. He thought maybe he'd publish a book about it someday. "It's kind of late in the season to get started, isn't it?" he said. "Why is that?" David asked.
"Well, the trail is 2,190 miles, most of it up and down mountains. Through hikers, the ones who hike the whole thing in one shot, usually give themselves 6 months, and they start out in the spring so they'll finish before the cold comes."
"I see."
"It's my fault. I spent way too much time planning the trip and buying all this hiking gear. I probably don't even need half of it. And then some sponsorship opportunities came up. And the next thing I knew, it was in the middle of June.
What made you want to turn Jim Bridger for 6 months? David asked. Charlene didn't answer. Her eyes were locked on a pair of 20-somethings getting up from a nearby table and leaving hand in hand. Mayer noticed she was fingering a gold charm bracelet on her wrist. Then he noticed a scrawl of white lines on the underside of her wrist. How will you get to Springer Mountain? He asked. She looked at him.
I was going to take the Greyhound from here to Atlanta and then figure it out from there. The trail starts about 80 miles north of the city, so I figured that I figured...
Greyhound! David shook his head. No, no, no. Marty and I will take you.
What?
Mayer and Charlene said in one voice. Absolutely.
Don't be ridiculous. You just got to New Orleans.
David waved away her objection. We've done the tourist Terzetto, Bourbon Street, Preservation Hall, Café du Monde. Besides, I've been here 100 times, and Mayer's hated the place ever since he got here.
Even so, Springer Mountain is hours out of your way.
That's just it. We don't have a way.
I'd be a third wheel.
Perfect. You'll keep us from tipping over. Charlene snorted a chortle and note of disbelief.
I don't know what to say. You guys are reckoning with the Everest of spiritual crises. What you need is each other, not me.
What we need, David said, putting a hand on her forearm, is a break from each other.
Uh-huh. Who's to say you and your brother won't go deliverance on me?
God is my witness, Charlene Valentine. We will deliver you to Springer Mountain unharmed.
This has been my guest, Reuben Fenton, reading, and I joined him, from his novel, Goyhood. Now, there's a reference now to that movie, Deliverance, which was filmed and takes place up in this northeastern corner of Georgia, where Charlene mm-hmm. wants to go. And this also brought to mind a novel that, no, it wasn't a novel, actually, that you probably read, and that was A Walk in the Woods by Bill Bryson. Have you read that book? It was...
In the past year, I did, as a matter of fact. Somebody recommended it to me, and it was a surprise I'd waited so long because I love hiking and I love the Appalachian Trail. I've never hiked it in its entirety.
Yeah, Bill Bryson, the book came out in 1998, but he actually walked the spring and summer of 1996. And I was particularly amused because I had already lived there and had moved by the time his book came out. But when... I thought of him, too, when Charlene says that she brought all his hiking gear. I probably don't even need half of it. And that's what Bill Bryson says, his walking companion, had all this gear that he did not need. So that's when I was thinking, oh, right. I'll bet Reuben read Bill Bryson's book, A Walk in the Woods.
And you're absolutely right. And as you may recall, he ends up tossing half of it off a cliff.
Yeah.
And like he gives
yeah, throwing it away. Yeah.
It was great. It was great. I mean, it was a miracle. That I when I started reading that book, his travel companion, whose name I don't recall, he's this big overweight guy, and like you assume he's never going to make it past 2 days doing this thing, but he actually perseveres. He hangs in there, which is really impressive because the Appalachian Trail is not easy. It gets very, very steep in parts.
Oh yeah, and at the time we were living there, I wasn't that motivated to hike the Appalachian Trail because I didn't think of myself as a hiker. But I am a pilgrim, and I, after that, walked the pilgrimage across Spain and across France, and I thought, oh, my gosh, it really was changing in the way that the characters mentioned this change. Now, there is a character in the book, too, that I haven't mentioned. He doesn't happen to be human, but I think dog lovers would enjoy this character. And who is that character, Reuben?
His name is Popeye, and he's a mixed breed, let's call him. He's a stray who the boys find at a parking lot in Biloxi, I believe it is.
Biloxi, yeah.
The poor Popeye is tied up to a lamppost, and so someone abandoned him there. And the implication is that he must have been one of those fighting dogs, because he's all scratched up and. One of his eyes is basically, doesn't work anymore. And he ends up playing a major role in this story, actually. No spoilers, but he actually saves the life of one of the characters at one point. And he's this beloved dog, and he was a lot of fun to write.
My guest is Reuven Fenton, and he has written a book, Goyhood. It's a novel, debut novel. Now, another thing that Mayer says, if he'd ever felt affection for the Big Apple, he lost it somewhere in the Smoky Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And
did
you kind of feel that way yourself?
Well, you know, in case your audience hasn't figured this out yet, I do spend an awful lot of time in the Big Apple. And, I must say, I didn't grow up in New York. I'm from Massachusetts. It's a beautiful town outside of Boston, the town of Lexington, which is very much not New York. And although I do spend an awful lot of time in New York, and I've grown to know the city awfully well, just given my job as a newspaper reporter over here, I know every inch of this city. But I got to say, at heart, it's not for me. And whenever I get the chance and I'm somewhere in nature, somewhere in a quiet place, a vast open space or a woodsy place or a mountaintop, I feel myself again. And New York City is a pressure cooker. It's a very intense place to live. It's very noisy, and there's never enough of anything. Whether it's, seating at a restaurant or space on the road, everyone's always fighting for something. It is a marvelous city in many respects, and hence its legendary status. But I must say, I do yearn oftentimes for natural spaces. I'm not talking Central Park. I'm talking real natural spaces.
Well, there's so much in your book that I want to save for readers. The mother is in this book is an interesting character, and her death brings a shocking revelation. But again, I'm going to save some of these things for the readers about these characters that you have created. So thank you for telling us about your novel, Reuven.
Oh, it's been so much fun. I so appreciate it.
Again, my guest has been journalist Reuven Fenton. His debut novel is Goyhood. I would also like to thank my first guest, Richard Parker, who has written a book on critical thinking. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
The Imposter and the Thief. You're a fraud. An imposter and a fake and a sod. I wish I was a Herbert or a Tolkien, but I'm not. How do I write what I love when what I love's already been done? Thoughts come in waves, the thief of joy in my mind, to tell me when I'm crazy, to tell me when I'm blind. The path of a writer is like a hero's journey, but the cycle just repeats in perpetual defeat. How many more years relying on small grants, limiting two classes so you don't get too stressed? But am I doing my best, or is that best not enough? Only doing what I need just to barely succeed. But who can I turn to get this off my chest? No one but my pen and book as an imposter among the rest. Brandon Quinones.
Storage unit. The persistence of memory in my mind does not look like dripping clocks with ants. It is mice droppings falling from chewed pages, leather covers cracked and foxed where the water got in, a repository of memorabilia, boxes and scrapbooks, photos, news clippings, children's art. I feel responsible to absorb all of this as I am one of the few who knew the main characters, who remembers the stories. The new 44 Chevy, canning peaches over the wood stove in August, trips to the lake, the dog that water skied, joy, sorrow, laughter, admiration pour into my mind, my head and hands holding the memories of decades. I am a water wheel receiving these gifts, a receptacle for one revolution. Unable to hold them all, I have to let go. To trust that the stream carries them on as it will my own. Hilary Lindauer-Vasey. old Adobe. Over the years, I have put so much time, energy, and will into being strong and independent, standing tall, being smart, wise, and intact, having answers, second guessing, moving on easily and quickly. Stalwart, like a building that is architecturally designed to withstand strong earthquakes, can remain standing no matter what. Steel structure, shiny 90-degree angles, sharp, even corners, many glass windows, pointed roof, a skyscraper. Uninviting, but steady and sure. Cold, but predictable and safe. Nice to admire, but void of warmth. Now all I want to be is a rustic, old adobe home. Years of rains, winds, snow, and sunshine layered on crumbling corners. Insects and roots baked into brown mud. Belonging to the earth, to God, to people. A home with a long history of sorrows and delights. Neither one being the better or worse. Full of stories, births, and deaths. Its walls aching with romances and betrayals. Smelling of pinon and baked bread. Music leaking out of blue-framed doors and windows. Cries, screams, moans, and laughter piled haphazardly in every corner. Untidy and even messy. With the things of life. Cupboards and closets full, rich, and stuffed with every emotion and experience that life has to offer. The name of God a covering on the floors, the windows, the beds. An old adobe whose only job is to house and hold every possible expression of a human existence and the blessing of life. My name is Joe Chavez.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.